सहना ववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ Good. Welcome back. Welcome also to our many students attending this class online. We proceed today with our study of Uddhava Gita, that's section of the Bhagavata Purana, and we begin today a new chapter in the Uddhava Gita, chapter 14. Now, as I've explained before, the chapters of the Uddhava Gita do not have names, like we're accustomed to in the Bhagavad Gita. And the names in the Bhagavad Gita anyway were added by some great scholar at a later date. So the names are not actually part of the text, and here we have no names. But you'll remember that our prior chapter, which was chapter 11, we concluded our study of last weekend. The topic of that chapter was the vibhutis, the glories of Ishvara, glories of Ishvara in the world, ways in which Ishvara is manifest in the world, meant for the sake of prayer, meditation, and cultivating Ishvara bhava. We had a nice, I enjoyed that study very much of that class. And it resembled in some ways chapter 10 of the Bhagavad Gita, which is also Vibhuti Yoga is the title of chapter 10, similar topic. Now we're continuing today with chapter 14, which means there are two chapters missing. And I'll remind you that we're not taking every single chapter of the Uddhava Gita. The Uddhava Gita is probably maybe twice as long, as a little bit more than twice as long as the Bhagavad Gita. But more than that, some of its materials are not in keeping, not appropriate for a student of Advaita Vedanta, which is our main topic here. They're important chapters, but maybe not as important. And to make that point clear, chapter 12 and 13 are the chapters we're skipping over. Both of these chapters deal with Swadharma. Swadharma in the sense of the duties you have in life. Of course, those duties you have in life will vary according to, in ancient times, they vary according to your caste, your varna. We don't follow that today, but if you lived at the time of Sri Krishna, according to if you were born in a family of a Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra, you would have very different responsibilities in life. Those responsibilities are described in these two chapters. Also, the responsibilities according to your ashrama, the stage of life. Four stages of life. The first two are brahmacharya, the stage of being a student, and grihastha, the stage of being a householder. The duties and responsibilities of those two ashramas are found in chapter 12, which we're skipping over. And chapter 13 is the duties and responsibilities of the last two ashramas, the ashramas of vanaprastha, retirement, and sannyasa, becoming a monk. So the responsibilities of how you live your life, and it means both religious responsibilities and social responsibilities are discussed in these two chapters, and it seemed to me best to skip over those two chapters. You can study them on your own if you choose to. There are many versions, many translations of the Bhagavata Purana available on the internet. So if you want to study those, you can continue. We're going to skip ahead to chapter 14. And I'll mention that for your studies, the slides with the translation that we use, the translation that I prepared, these slides are always available on our website if you want to print them out and use them for your own study. Some people like to take notes, so it's always available. As I said, the chapters don't have titles, so chapter 14 is known as chapter 14. Chatur Dasha Adhyayaha. The 14th chapter is the best we can do. I'll tell you briefly what are the topics in chapter 14, and then we'll begin. The first topic is enlightenment. What a way to begin. One other place, I said, to use the American metaphor, I said Sri Krishna likes to begin with a bang, a big start off. I think the Olympics in Paris have just begun with some kind of big event. So first topic, enlightenment. In the middle of the chapter, we find a discussion on bhakti, Sri Krishna teaching Uddhava about bhakti. If we want to make a comparison between Uddhava Gita and Bhagavad Gita, I think it would be a fair comparison to say that a central, not the central focus, but a central focus of the Bhagavad Gita is Karma Yoga. We would say Karma Yoga is a topic that's given more emphasis than any other topic. In the Uddhava Gita, we would say that bhakti has that same role. Bhakti is given more importance than any other topic. Of course, all the topics that are important to a spiritual aspirant are covered without leaving anything out in both the Bhagavad Gita and the Uddhava Gita. But here we see the topic of bhakti emphasized, and we'll see that in the middle of chapter 14. And then towards the end of chapter 14, Uddhava, I just have this feeling that Uddhava has been waiting and waiting to ask questions. And he's waiting and waiting and waiting. He gets more and more and more questions. So when he finally gets a chance to ask, he asks Sri Krishna a series of 20 questions, one after another, and then the remainder of the chapter is Sri Krishna's answer to all of those questions. I just made a comment here. The commentator on this text, one Sridhara Swami, he makes an interesting observation about the connection between chapters 12, 13, and leading up to chapter 14. 12 and 13 had to do with the duties of each stage of life. All of those stages of life meant to prepare you for enlightenment, which is the topic of chapter 14. So we will take a leap, skip over all those stages of life, and proceed to chapter 14, where our topic is enlightenment. Thank you. All right. And as always, as I'm chanting, read the translation and then repeat after me. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, Yo Vidya Shruta Sampannaha, Yo Vidya Shruta Sampannaha, Atma Vananumanikaha, Atma Vananumanikaha, Maya Matramidam Jnatva, Maya Matramidam Jnatva, Jnanam Chamayi Sanyaset, Mayi Chamayi Sanyaset. Good. So talking about the enlightened person is one Yaha who is Sampannaha, endowed. Endowed with vidya, spiritual wisdom, which is shruta, heard. Spiritual wisdom, which is heard. Shruta suggests shruti, and shruti means the scriptures specifically that come from the ancient rishis, the Vedas. Shruti refers to Vedas, and the Vedas are the source texts for all these spiritual teachings, including the Bhagavata Purana, which then is a secondary category of scripture, one of the 18 Mahapuranas. But Sri Krishna here refers to one who is Vidya Shruta, one who has listened to the wisdom of the ancient rishis as unfolded in the scriptures. And we have to, whenever we say one who has heard the scriptures, there's something else implied but not often stated explicitly. And that is, the scriptures are in Sanskrit. So if you don't know Sanskrit, then you need, I'm just going to make it very clear. If you don't know Sanskrit, you need a guru. And even if you know Sanskrit, if you don't know this entire tradition, you still need a guru. Because you need to not only be able to understand the Sanskrit properly, you need to be able to interpret it properly in the context of the whole body of scriptures, the whole scriptural tradition. If you focus on, you know, the problem many people have is even if they know Sanskrit, they'll take one verse out of context and translate it horribly because it's out of context. Everything gets meaning in context. So, and if you say, well, I'll read translations, fine, you can and should read translations, but reading a translation is not reading the text. It's just not. Every translation has its limitations. Every translation has its own spin put on it, its own orientation, its own bias based on the translator. That includes, by the way, my translations. So a pious Vaishnava might not like some of my translations because my tradition is not Vaishnavism. My tradition is Advaita Vedanta, and that's fine. So if you are a pious Vaishnava, you might enjoy Prabhupada Swami's translation. Doesn't work for me. In fact, I don't want to belabor this point. No, when you learn Sanskrit properly, you kind of get allergic to translations. Because you become more, and especially when you do, I'll just one minute. I have, you know, all of this I translate from the original Sanskrit, and I've been doing this for 30 years. So how much have I translated by now? A lot. And translating a lot of material makes you really, really sensitive to the shortcomings of translations, all translations, including my own translations. I struggle with the problem that many Sanskrit words have no English equivalents. And not only that, but the topic, the subject matters that we're dealing with are very subtle and difficult to express clearly and succinctly. So having become so sensitized to the difficulty of translation, whenever I look at even a good translation, the shortcomings just leap off the page, as it were. I'm not trying to discourage you from reading translations. I read a lot of translations before I learned properly. They all helped me, but they all had their limitations. So I'd just like you to appreciate the limitations of translations, and therefore the need to not only study independently, but to study with the help of a qualified teacher. Okay, that in mind, Vidya Shruta Sampannaha, one who has studied the scriptures, is not necessarily enlightened. A lot of scholars, Varanasi, in Banaras, Kashi, there are many Sanskrit universities with great scholars who have studied so much more than I have. They make me look like a scholastic midget. Really? They have studied that much compared. So me, in comparison to them, I am I like that term, scholastic midget. Not only is my height short. Anyway, you get the point. Scholastic midget. But how many of those great scholars do you think are enlightened? Come into their class late and you'll find out. Why are you late? They'll get upset. You know, they have egos. They're part of this whole academic structure and hierarchy and all of this stuff. Anyway, you can be a scholar without being enlightened. But here, Sri Krishna, and first word is one who is a scholar. So, Shvidya Shruta, one who has studied the scriptures. But the very next word is Atmavan, one who has discovered one's true nature. Satchidananda Atma, one who can say, I am that. Aham Brahmasmi. Someone who can say it and mean it. That's it. It's easy to say, Aham Brahmasmi, but to mean it. So that one is Atmavan. But that one is also Na Anumanikaha. And this is almost a dig at the scholars. Because scholars are really good at using logic, reasoning, and inference. And they rely on it. They rely on their scholarship. They rely on inference. So here Sri Krishna is talking about Na Anumanikaha, one who doesn't rely on scholarship because they have personally discovered this truth. And what have they discovered further? Gnatva, in the third line, having discovered Maya Matram Idam. Idam, this world, is Maya Matram. It is merely Maya, but be careful to translate Maya contextually. In different contexts, Maya can mean magic. The world is not magical. Maybe you go to Disneyland or something, might be. But the world is not magic, nor is the world illusion. Maya means illusion in other contexts, not in Advaita Vedanta, not in the Bhagavata Purana. It doesn't mean illusion. What it means is something that is less real, something that depends existing on something else. It's like your dream world. Your dream world, while you're in the dream, it's very real. But then it goes away. In the same way, this world, from your standpoint of experience, is very real. This isn't an illusion. The arm of the chair and the arm of the Swami are not illusions. They're experienced as real. But they're just not completely real. Just as in a dream, if this were my dream, this seems real, then I wake up and it's gone. In the same way, in this world, in the non-dream world, this seems real and this seems real, but you wake up out of the dream of ignorance, so to speak, and you discover that it's not as real as it seems. That's not our topic here. We've discussed it before, and it may come again in this chapter. So having discovered the fact that the world is not as real as it seems, what should that person, that enlightened person, do? What should that enlightened person do? Sri Krishna gives some interesting advice. He says that person, jnanam sanyaset, jnanam cha sanyaset. That person should give up, sanyaset, should give up, not give up their conventional life and become a sannyasi, although it has the same verbal root as in sannyasa. But what you're supposed to give up here is not conventional life, but give up jnanam. Huh? You should give up knowledge? Mayi, unto me, you should surrender your jnanam. Let us put it, again, interpretation. Jnanam could mean your study. So this person studied a lot of scriptures to gain enlightenment, a lot of meditation to gain enlightenment. But where is the necessity of further study and meditation after gaining enlightenment? Where's the necessity? There's no more need, no more necessity. Doesn't mean you stop. So it doesn't mean you become, when you become alert, when you become enlightened, now you become allergic to studying scriptures and meditation, right? Huh? That doesn't make sense, right? So if you have studied all these scriptures and done all this meditation, and if it led you to enlightenment, you'll have a great love for it. It'll absolutely continue, but not as a matter of need, not a matter of necessity. There's a wonderful story about this, a story that doesn't come in scripture, but comes in a work of a British author, Somerset Maugham. Not a popular author, but he wrote this well-known book, The Razor's Edge, which is based loosely on a British man meeting Ramana Maharshi, based loosely on that story. Anyway, at the end of the story, the protagonist, this British man, has become enlightened. I have to set up the stage. Guru told him to take all of his scriptures and go sit on top of this mountain and stay there until you're enlightened. So he takes all his books, goes up to this mountain, he gets enlightened, and it happens to be in late fall, winter sets in, and this poor fellow is enlightened and shivering and chattering and all of this. So enlightenment doesn't mean you don't get cold. So what did he do? He started a fire and started burning the pages of the scriptures he brought with him, one after another, they had served their purpose. That's the idea. So in a sense, jnanam sanyaset mayi, Sri Krishna says, that enlightened person should surrender all of the scriptural learning, all of the scripture, all of the sadhana, spiritual practice, should surrender it unto me. Then, jnaninastvaham eveshtaha
swartho hetuscha sammataha. Swartho hetuscha sammataha, swargaschaivapavargascha, nanyortho madrate priyaha.
Good. I think my ears aren't working. You hear me okay? Okay, my ears are fine, I do nothing. Sri Krishna goes on to describe that enlightened person, jnaninaha. For that enlightened person, you have to break these words apart. Jnaninaha tu aham eva ishtaha. Tu, in particular, jnaninaha, for the enlightened person, aham eva, I alone am ishtaha, the one who is desired. So, and Sri Krishna here is speaking to Uddhava, I alone am that who is the one who is desired, the one who is desirable, the one who is the source of contentment, peace, happiness, joy, serenity. And Sri Krishna is referring to himself not as an avatara of Lord Vishnu here. Sri Krishna refers to himself many times in the Bhagavad Gita, Uddhava Gita, and elsewhere. He refers to himself again and again and again as the divinity who dwells within you. Antaratma, the inner self, Satchidananda Atma. He does so many times in the Bhagavad Gita. He does so many times in the Uddhava Gita. So Sri Krishna says, for the enlightened person has recognized my presence. These are Sri Krishna's words. The enlightened person has recognized my presence within himself or herself as his true self, the inner divinity, Satchidananda Atma. And for that enlightened person, I am that which is ishta, that which is most desirable. And he gives five different ways of describing that goal that the enlightened person has gained. That enlightened person has gained what is desired. What is desired? Swartaha. Swartha, one's own goal in life. The ultimate goal, and the ultimate goal, as we've discussed in many, many classes, to be content, peaceful, free from suffering is the goal. So that is swartha, one's goal. And hetuhu, the means for gaining that goal. So how do you gain perfect peace and contentment? Not by going to the mall, nor by going to Paris for these big Olympics. You won't find contentment in the mall. You won't find contentment in Paris or any other place. That contentment is found within. These teachings lead you within. That is the hetu, the teachings which lead you within. And that person has discovered sammataha, a conclusion, clear, conclusive knowledge that my true nature is Satchidananda Atma, which is the actual source of contentment and peace. This person has discovered what some people call swarga. Swarga means heaven, but here it's referring to a life free from suffering. That is what distinguishes swarga. In the Hindu tradition, swarga is merely another life. Here we have an earthly life. We live a lifetime and get reborn. You can have a lifetime in heaven and then get reborn. What distinguishes these two lives is this is a life, suffering, happiness, suffering, happiness, suffering, happiness is alternation. In heaven, if happiness, happiness, some people say, wouldn't that be boring? To be free from suffering is not boring. Okay, enough said. So swarga, this condition is called, and also apavarga. Apavarga is a technical term often used for enlightenment. Enlightenment, moksha, liberation, freedom from suffering. So the enlightened person has gained that ultimate goal in life. The commentator says he is krita kritya. The one who has done everything that needs to be done for the sake of freedom from happiness and inner peace. Imagine a to-do list for your entire life, and one of those items is get enlightened. The shortcut is if your to-do list for your lifetime is 1,000 items long, I have no idea how long it might be, if it's 1,000 items long, one of those items happens to be get enlightened, if you do that one, you're done. You don't, the other 999 items on the to-do list are no longer crucial. You may still do them because they need to be done, but you no longer, your contentment no longer depends on all these other 999 items on your to-do list. That person is krita-kritya, simply fulfilled, santushta. And finally, Sri Krishna says, na anyaha artha, na anyaha artha priyaha madrate. For that person, na anyaha artha priyaha, nothing else is desirable. I'm laughing because you could put this line in a Bollywood movie. Because here Sri Krishna says, no one else, nothing else is desirable in life except me. It's like the heroine telling the hero, I am all you need. All you need is me in your life, she says. So this is a line out of a Bollywood movie, but it has a very different meaning here. So here Sri Krishna once again refers to himself as that inner divinity. There is nothing else you need in life except to discover that inner divinity. Then, jnana vijnana samsiddhaha, jnana vijnana samsiddhaha, param shreshtam vidur mama, param shreshtam vidur mama, jnani priyatamo to me, jnani priyatamo to me, jnane nasau bibharti mam, jnane vasau bibharti mam. Jnana vijnana samsiddhaha. Now we're plural in number, talking about not one enlightened person, but all of the enlightened persons who are samsiddhaha, perfected, means enlightened. They are perfected how? Through jnana and vijnana. Sri Krishna also uses these two terms side by side in, I think, chapter 9 is jnana vijnana yoga. And obviously, they have to have different meanings. Superficially, they both look like they mean knowledge. In the Bhagavad Gita, they end up having different meanings. After all, chapter 9 is about bhakti and not knowledge. But here, they also have different meanings. Sri Krishna just used the word jnanam in the terms of scriptural studies. And we said that scriptural studies don't necessarily make you enlightened. You can be a great scholar and still have a really bad attitude, as some scholars might have, not enlightened. So here, jnana refers to that scholarship, and vijnana refers to, we could call it, realization. It means the personal recognition of the truth revealed by these teachings of the scriptures. I'd like to share with you two Sanskrit words that are really important and relevant here. There's a distinction made with regard to knowledge, two kinds of knowledge. One is called direct knowledge, and the other is called indirect knowledge. Direct knowledge is called aparoksha, and indirect knowledge is called paroksha. It's almost the same word. I won't bother writing it on the. Paroksha means indirect. Aparoksha means direct. You see me, and you have knowledge that I am sitting here in front of you, whether you're in the lecture hall or watching on your computer. Your knowledge of me is direct. Aparoksha, you see me directly sitting in front of you. You see me directly on whatever screen you're watching. This we can call aparoksha jnanam, direct knowledge, as opposed to if you see fire rising from a mountainside, you know there's fire on the mountain. Right? That's inference. Wherever there's smoke, there's fire. You see the smoke, you infer the presence of fire. That's inferential knowledge. Inferential knowledge is knowledge, but it's not direct knowledge. It's indirect knowledge. Your knowledge of me sitting here, aparoksha, direct. Your knowledge of the fire, you don't see the fire, but you know it's there. That is indirect knowledge. That is paroksha jnanam. So here, that to study the scriptures as a scholar gives you indirect knowledge, paroksha jnanam. For example, what would be the example of paroksha jnanam of me? I can think of, here's clever. Suppose you're late. By the way, I said, be on time for the meditation class. You can be late for any other class. I don't mind. So suppose right now, halfway through the class, you're in the lobby. You're really quite late for this class, but you hear me talking. In the lobby, you hear me talking. You don't see me, but you know I'm here. You infer my presence in the lecture hall. That is indirect knowledge, inferential knowledge, paroksha jnanam. So in Advaita Vedanta, we start through studying the scriptures, we gain indirect knowledge. My true nature is something called Atma, which is said to be Satchidananda. That's indirect knowledge. The reality because of which the world exists is said to be Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma, indirect knowledge. That's scholarship. Over time, with the help of a guru, with the intense effort on your part to be engaged in a process of self-inquiry, which is the main practice of Advaita Vedanta, Atma Vichara, self-inquiry guided by scripture, that process then can help you. It's accurate to say we convert indirect knowledge into direct knowledge. If you're standing in the lobby and walk in the door, your indirect knowledge is converted into direct knowledge. If you see the smoke on the mountain and then hike up there and see the fire, your indirect knowledge is converted into direct knowledge. So here, jnanam, indirect knowledge, gets converted into vijnanam, direct knowledge, enlightenment. And those who are samsiddhaha, those who are enlightened, because their indirect knowledge has been converted into direct knowledge, what about them? They, end of the next line, viduhu, they know. They know mama param shreshtam. They know that mama param, my abode, my essence, my being is shreshtam, the highest. And again, Sri Krishna is speaking as the inner divinity. The enlightened one knows that my presence within them is the highest abode. Mama shreshtam param. So, therefore, Sri Krishna says, makes an interesting conclusion here. Third line towards the end. Ataha, therefore, jnani, that enlightened person is me priyatamaha. Sri Krishna says the same thing in the Bhagavad Gita. In chapter 4, I actually remember where these things are now. In chapter 4, he says that the jnani is priyatama, the one who is most dear to me. Sri Krishna plays favorites. He says priyatama, most dear. He's playing favorites. That's not fair, people say. here's the point. In fact, the point becomes clear when you see the last line. In the last line, he says, asau, jnanena asau bibharti mam. Asau, that enlightened person, jnanena, through his or her knowledge, bibharti mam, literally supports me, cherishes me would be a better translation, embraces me, recognizes my immediate presence. And here's the point. The enlightened person is one who knows Sri Krishna directly and not indirectly. We just got done talking about direct and indirect knowledge. The enlightened person relates to Sri Krishna as being present in one's experience. I'll say that again. The enlightened person relates to Ishvara, in this case Sri Krishna, as being immediately present in one's experience as that inner divinity. The inner divinity is not outside. It is you, the essence of who you are. That is an immediate recognition. That is direct knowledge, as opposed to the unenlightened person who is devoted to Sri Krishna but only has indirect knowledge. What is that indirect knowledge? When you look at Sri Krishna on the altar, that's indirect knowledge, right? You know it is Sri Krishna, but it's not Sri Krishna in an essential manner. It's a form, a murti. By the way, please don't ever use the word idol. I've made this point before. It is a quick aside. The word idol in American English, look it up in a dictionary. Dictionary says a false god. That's the American meaning. In India, fine, call it idol. Not in this country. False idol. So that deity on the altar, that murti, that form, when you see that form, you're seeing Krishna indirectly. It's like hearing me from the lobby. Better to go inside and see me directly. Better to discover Sri Krishna's presence in your own heart. So this is a distinction between the enlightened and not quite enlightened. The enlightened person, now Priyatamaha, is that person is more fond, that person is more beloved to me because that person sees me directly, that person is directly connected to me, not indirectly connected. Okay, we can see at least one more verse. Tapastirtam japodanam, tapastirtam tapodanam, pavitrani tarani cha, pavitrani tarani cha, nalam kurvanti tam siddhim, nalam kurvanti tam siddhim, jnana kalaya krita. Yajnana kalaya krita. Okay. Na, in a third line, na alam kurvanti tam siddhim. There are certain things which are na alam, not sufficient to kurvanti, to bring about tam siddhim, that state of perfection, that enlightenment. Certain things are not capable of bringing about that state of perfection, the state we understand as enlightenment, liberation, moksha. What are those things which are insufficient? Tapas, austerities, tirtham, going on pilgrimage, japaha, chanting mantras, danam, charity, pavitrani, itrani cha, and itrani, other pavitrani, other sacred deeds, other pious acts. All these pious acts are na alam, not enough. Did he say you shouldn't do them? That's not what he's saying, right? Na alam. In a technical sense, some of you have heard this term here before. Necessary but insufficient. Na alam. Necessary but insufficient. The message being that tapas won't make you enlightened, But without some discipline in your life, you're not likely to get enlightened. Tirtham, going on pilgrimage, will not make you enlightened, but without spending some time in holy places, maybe you won't get enlightened. Japa, chanting mantras alone won't make you enlightened, but without chanting mantras, it's much harder to get enlightened. Similarly, dhanam and other pious acts alone won't make you enlightened, but without pious acts, you are not likely to become enlightened. Necessary, but insufficient. And there's just a quick point here. There's a technical reason for that. And these are all deeds. Every act, in fact, we just got done with this discussion in our Vedanta class on Sunday. Shankaracharya is teaching this very same point. He makes this point very, very powerfully. He says that these are all deeds. Any deed you do is done by you, a finite and limited person. So any deed you accomplish will have a finite and limited result. Means a temporary result. So you live a pious life, but living and only living that pious life doesn't culminate in enlightenment, does culminate in some temporary blessings. For example, you might go to heaven, but then you get reborn. After your karma is exhausted in heaven, it's a temporary result. So the point is, Shankara makes this point very strongly. There's a technical basis here, and that is all deeds are done by a person who is finite and limited. Therefore, the result of all deeds is necessarily finite and limited. If you want an infinite and limitless result, moksha, deeds, actions, even pious actions, na alam, are not enough. Jnanam, and jnanam in the sense of immediate knowledge, the personal discovery of your true nature as Satchidananda Atma, that inner divinity, that is alam. And then Sri Krishna ends this verse with a poetic device called hyperbole. Let me explain. Hyperbole is actually, it's a term, it's used in linguistics as a technical term, and it means intentional, deliberate exaggeration. And it's what you see in every commercial you've ever seen on television. If somebody is selling their product, and suppose their product is some kind of mug, they'll say, Yeti mug, says Yeti. the advertisement will say, this Yeti mug, look at this mug. Wow, I never looked at it actually before, but it is stainless steel with a nice orange-colored coating. How nice is that? Oh, here, it says Yeti more clearly. You can see it says Yeti. And it's got this nice plastic lid, and it. I think they say that there are no PFAs in this plastic. Those forever chemicals, not there. So this is not a good mug. This is the best mug. They also cost $20 or something like that. Okay, when was the last time you spent $20 on a mug? Anyway, this is not a good mug. This is the best. Sab se acha. So this is hyperbole. Intentionally exaggeration, which is used all the time in poetry. So, and the point is that if you, and you'll see when we get to the verse in just a moment, if I say this is the best mug, and then you say, prove it. Can I prove it? That's pretty good. But I can't prove it. Hyperbole. In the same way, what Sri Krishna says in the next line is hyperbole, which means if you say, prove it, it doesn't work that way. So he says that this, where am I? Here. Yajnana kalaye krita. And you have to connect it to na alam tam siddhim. The siddhi, the accomplishment that you can gain compared to what you can achieve through tapas, tirtha, japa, all of these pious acts about, compared to all of them, what you get is na alam, and I'm going to translate it a little differently, it is trivial. It is trivial compared to yakrita, what you can accomplish, how, jnana kalaya. Kala is a little bit, a little drop. And he says, what you can accomplish through all of these pious acts is insignificant to what you can accomplish with just a little drop of knowledge. Is there such a thing as a little drop of knowledge? This is a point. Jnana kala cannot be taken literally. There's no such thing as a little bit of knowledge. When you see me sitting here, can you have a little bit of knowledge? You either see me or you don't. Even if you take your glasses off, you see me. I'm just fuzzy. But you still see me. So you either see me or you don't. There's no such thing as a little bit of knowledge. This last line is hyperbole. Just this knowledge is so wonderful. If Sri Krishna were on a commercial, we will end with this. I just to be a little silly here at the end of the class, you turn on your TV, Sri Krishna is giving a commercial advertisement for moksha. In particular, his teachings leading to moksha. And he says, these teachings are so powerful. Just a little bit will make you enlightened. Best. You get the point. Okay, so we'll conclude with that. He continues with this topic. We'll see next week when we continue our class. Quick announcements. Tomorrow we have our Shankara's class. I mentioned that the logic of a finite effort cannot give an infinite result. That's exactly what we're studying in Shankara's text. That class continues tomorrow at 10 o'clock, followed by satsang at 11 o'clock. Come with your questions. Also, last week after class, we had a gardening project. Many of you volunteered. You got a lot done, and things look wonderful out there. I want to thank all of you who volunteered for that gardening project. We'll conclude with our prayers.
Om gananahantva ganapatigamavamahe kavingavinam hupamashravastamam jeshtarajam brahmanam brahmanaspatahanashrinvan uttivisirasaranam Om mahaganapataye namaha Ishvaro Guru Radmeti Murti Bhairavi Bhagine Vyomavad Vyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsachanura Mardanam Devaki Paramhanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, Om Shanti, 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 Om Tat Sat.